Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And today I'm once again joined by Luciano Pozzole. So Luciano, thank you for joining me again. Obviously, you are one of the people behind the Children of Ash.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I love your episodes. I think you've been on...
Oh, thanks a lot.
Two or three times before.
I think it's the fourth time now.
I think so. Really? And yeah. Every time there is some information that blows my mind. It's always so fascinating. So I'm really looking forward to this different angle we're going to look at today as well.
Yeah, I hope we can actually, talk about, less of quantity, but of more of mentality and what you think about things and, what's behind the scenes. That's more interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the past, we focused very much on the different art styles, when they started, when they finished, what makes each one individual. Yeah. But today we're going to try and look at what, like you said, what we know about mentality based on the artwork and what we can learn from it, which I think is very fascinating.
It's absolutely, incredible, because it's the type of stuff that you don't expect. It's a very particular research I kind of do, because I don't go with an idea that I want to, I have a theory and I want to prove it. Mm-hmm. I just analyze and see what turns out. So it could be anything.
Mm-hmm. But I guess that's a good way to be very unbiased, that it's it is what it is. You're not kind of going in there thinking it's already going to be a set
idea. I get proved wrong all the time by the ancestors, like all the time. Yeah.
That's a good way to be, because it feels, I've always wondered this, and I spoke with Matthias about it quite a bit, how, people put their lives work, scholars will put their whole life dedicated to one area. And then in an instant, you could have a discovery that just makes everything you've done almost redundant, or at least wrong. And that must be difficult to swallow. That must be a hard pill.
It is. I mean, it's like with the other member of Children of Ashes, an archaeologist, Lars Grünwald, and he's been working on, he's been studying for a few years and is actually preparing a PhD on a set of medallions that had a from the Yelling period, and they had a political value. They were designed to actually, as a sort of branding system. Mm-hmm. So they found the matrices in Hedeby, and the finished products all in various parts of Scandinavia, and they were sort of tokens of alliance actually. Yeah,
is the matrix the kind of original stamp?
What they are, they're called patrices. It's more like the masculine version of the matrix.
Okay.
So it's a convex kind of pattern, mm-hmm. on top of which they laid a piece of a thin layer of either silver or gold, and then they hammered it down. So they had a sort of shape. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, they built all filigree beasts. Mm-hmm. And the patrices have been found always in the same place. So that kind of consolidated the idea that was the main workshop of Gorm the Old.
Okay.
And that from there, he actually distributed these sigils as a token of alliance and belonging to his retinue or connection. But recently we have found a Patris in Sweden. And that messes things.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, no. So it appears like that would be almost like a minting office for
minting
coins. That's the only place you can get this coin from.
Exactly.
And I assume you wouldn't spend it then if it was like a lion's coin.
It's a bit more complex than a coin. It's a medallion this big with lots of filigree construction on top. So it's like a fancy medallion.
Oh, okay, I'm with you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it has, and it also has a symbolic value. So you had two beasts, and then three beasts, and then four beasts, depending on the type of alliance. So it could be
you could level up.
Pretty much, yes, absolutely.
So yeah. Everybody wants the four beast. If you were a two beast, then you're not worth anything.
Well, probably the ones that were less entangled with the king's power had a lesser type of connection. For example, they found two silver medallions with two beasts in Gotland. Because Gotland was sort of running its own game.
Yeah. Silver, two beasts.
Yeah.
Nothing. Nobody's. They're not that important.
Exactly. But they were, they were independent enough. They didn't really care.
No. So what do you think the Patris that was found in Sweden or... What do you think that is? Do you think maybe it's just been taken there after the fact, or maybe could it even be like somebody trying to replicate? Is that a thing?
That would be really unusual, really, because I think they were. I mean, from the evidence we've found, they were very strict about their brand.
Mm-hmm.
Between Yelling and Mammon style, they were really, really strict. Even, there's probably other states, structures could not use those styles.
Yeah.
Like without consequences, let's say.
I mean, there's always somebody willing to risk the consequences sometimes, though.
Oh, Gotland did. They actually did a sort of, there are a couple of brooches that actually mimic Mammon style, but it's just slightly different.
Okay.
And they filled this brooch with bears.
Mm-hmm.
And bears are animals that were never used in Mammon style, just demonstratively. It's like, it's not your thing. It's something else. So it's 12 bears on one brooch.
Okay. Yeah, you showed me that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Showed me that.
Mm-hmm.
That actually leads me on quite well to something that I wanted to ask you whilst I've got you here and I can use your expertise. Recently, I've been doing a bunch of research on different places particularly in Yorkshire, where there may be very cool items from the Viking Age that haven't quite made it into one of the big main museums like the British Museum, or there's a big one in Durham and one up in Cumbria. But there's still like a really fascinating artifact that might be just sat in a church that not many people know about. So I went to see a place, it's like the Viking door in Stillingfleet, and it's this beautiful door with a like lovely ironwork on it. And then last week I went to the site of the Repton man, who was a warrior found with, they think, his son next to him, and a burial ground next to it of about 260 plus bodies were found in it that they think was a burial ground for maybe the great heathen army. It's a really fascinating place, and I've been going around and visiting these places and making little videos, and we're going to do some short form YouTube videos as part of the podcast in the future.
Sounds good.
And one of the one of these really interesting things that I found was these things called hogback stones. Mm-hmm. And they, I don't know if you've heard of them before, but they seem to be predominantly in the British Isles, and they're like a tombstone almost, but they're shaped kind of like a hog's back in that kind of elong, like a pyramid, but like length, like a Toblerone almost.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. they have animals, two animal heads on each side. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have, I think they have hogs on, mm-hmm. but there is some in Brompton, mm-hmm. that I'm going to pull up to show you now. Mm-hmm. So there were some in Brompton, and two of them were bought by, or a few of them were bought by the Durham Cathedral. So these have their bears mm-hmm. on either side.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of them do, but their mouths are bound shut by like some sort of rope or some sort of tie around mm-hmm. around their mouths. So you can see they're quite clearly bears.
Yeah.
And around their mouth, it's like a, must be like a rope or something. I think that's the only pictures on there of them. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what maybe you thought of that, or if you'd seen anything.
I've never seen them in Scandinavia, or at least not many. But the first impression I get is that they look very strongly like longhouses.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that's commented on. And I'll just see if I could find a better picture of the bear. But
they look like tiles, also the patterns on top of them, you know.
Okay.
You know, like the tiles on the head of the top on the ridge of a longhouse.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And it was, I was wondering if there was any, because as far as I know, nobody actually knows the reason as to why there are the bears with this binding over their mouths. And I thought if anybody might have ever experienced or seen anything like this anywhere else, it might be you. So I thought I'd ask you if you'd ever even come across anything like that in any of the artwork you'd seen.
Not turned inwards. I've seen them turned outwards.
Okay.
But on a Kamen casket is built like that.
Mm-hmm.
It has beasts on the, because on the two edges, you'd have the doors.
Yeah.
So over the doors, you'd have protective animals, especially if they're looking outwards. The fact they're looking inwards, they're tied to it, is a very interesting concept. I mean, it's maybe quite a specific kind of symbology. It's very difficult to tell out mm-hmm. of, you know, like, I mean, it's when they're outward bound, it's much more, you know, it gives the impression of a protective kind of structure, you know, like, just so you've got the two doors. And then, you know, if you look at the, now share my screen for a second.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it would make sense having these protective animals on a tombstone, I guess. But it just feels very odd to me that the mouths would be bound if they were meant to be protective. Because obviously they've gone through the level of care to add the bindings of the mouth. It just feels quite quite an unusual thing. And I know that these stones were only popular, I think it was up until the 11th century. Yeah. I think it was a very short period of maybe like 200-300 years where these had popularity, and then they dropped out of favor quite quickly. I was reading it, and it doesn't seem like anybody has a strong theory as to why. So
yeah, the bears looking inwards, might be connected. I mean, I don't know if just, you know, this is a feeling and it just has zero academic value, but it makes me think of the Oseberg ship with the huge boulder at the front that is the ship is tied to,
mm-hmm.
as if they're trying to hold the ship down instead of letting it go somewhere else. It's as if they are tying those beasts to the to that house. At least, you know, it's like a sort of
maybe holding them down. I wonder if it could be some sort of representation of tying the beasts to the person, maybe the person who's buried underneath. Maybe it's you're tying them to that person for the afterlife.
Exactly. That could be. Yes. The problem is, you know, like that's what I was telling you. It's just like the unpredictability of what I discover is that, you know, like it's very rare that I see one thing and I say, okay, that signifies that. You know, generally I go through an enormous amount of data, lots of contextual information within the same type of imagery. And then perhaps, if I'm lucky, I get to certain... Yeah, generally you start identifying what the symbols are. But, you know, then lots of speculation starts, generally speaking. But you can work your way around those speculations if you know how to work.
Yeah. I know I unfairly dropped that on you. I didn't mention it to you until five minutes before the show. I was like, oh, by the way, can I get your opinion on this?
Absolutely. No problem.
But it is, I do find things like that fascinating. And if you're listening to this, keep an eye out on our YouTube channel. There is a bunch of short form, let's say short form, like shorter than a podcast, maybe like 15 minute videos of different fun places that I've been to. And there's a bunch on our Instagram as well, just a really short minute and a half reels. So just pop over to our YouTube channel. It's just Northern Mythology Podcast and hit the little subscribe button and then you can check them out when they come out. But yeah, I'm really enjoying that actually. It's
all right. Yeah. Yeah. I like those too.
What I find frustrating is that I don't know why I keep falling into this trap of naivety, thinking that there's just going to be this database that I can find where it's going to tell me of all the cool stuff that's in Yorkshire. And I can just be like, yeah, I'll just go visit this and tick it off. And then when I started looking, I'm like, that just doesn't exist. No. I've actually got to really work to find these places.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Should we?
I'm actually moving towards the British Isles in a certain sense, because I'm working on a very ambitious project looking towards the origin of Viking art. And it actually seems to technically come from the British Isles.
Oh, Don. So many people will get upset by that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a complicated thing because it's, you know, it's like it's your podcast, so it's complicated.
Yeah.
The technology that is used it seems to have been borrowed from the British Isles, but then it was transformed into their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they used the technological possibilities of the medium to actually express different things. So they actually consciously diverged from the Celtic monastic kind of jewelry.
So would that be just, is that the art style itself of like the way the artwork moves, or like the technique of putting that onto brooches and caskets and things like that? Because I imagine they're two very different things. One is like the way the art flows, and one is again like the technique of.
Well, the way the art flows actually is dependent from the original technique. Like knotwork as we know it and as it's developed through Celtic monastic art in the British Isles, and then was taken over and transformed through the Scandinavians, was made in metal.
Okay.
Metal.
Yeah. Right. Not that kind of metal.
Not that kind of metal. But it was chip engraved, technically. So they made a sort of mold through engraving sort of slanted surfaces between the top surface of the design.
Okay.
There is some technological issues. So the whole knotwork system comes from certain technical necessities. For example, because you don't want the background of your plate to be flat, because it's an incredible amount of work and it's crazy work. I mean, it was done sometimes, but what was normally done is that you have the surface of the design and in the negative space, you have slanted surfaces that would meet in lines. So you so that forces those surfaces to move in a certain way. And that's how those triquetral forms and the oval shapes got their origin. You know, they were forced in a certain direction because of the technical necessities.
Okay, so it was more difficult to leave it blank.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then I guess over time they just developed a way to make it more and more ornate and complex. And
exactly, but because also there is a big misunderstanding, modernly speaking, about that kind of also the Celtic monastic metalwork with all the crosses and stuff and the regular knotwork. Because those were they also had these slanted surfaces, and these slanted surfaces are part of the design. When you see them transcribed on books, they only transcribe the surface image, so the positive space. But the negative space is made out of surfaces of metal, shiny surfaces of metal. So. And if you have a lot of surfaces in the same line, they will catch light at the same time. It's a bit like a diamond kind of thing. So you'd have a sort of 3D image because you move it and a whole line of surfaces will light up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you turn it around and another number of surfaces will light up, so you get like a sort of it's these creatures would come alive with, you know, also the knotwork would just, you know, feel three-dimensional. So we are looking at just a two-dimensional thing. It's like looking at a sphere and seeing a circle, you know what I mean?
Okay, so I every time I just get so fascinated with how complex and in depth this stuff was, and the quality of work. I still don't really understand how we spoke about this for at least 4 hours now, and I still don't understand how they created some of these pieces.
Oh, it is crazy, because, you know, I'll show you a couple of pieces I'm working on now. It's just like my holy grail of Viking art, which is a bridle set for horse riding from Broa, which gives the name to the style.
Okay.
And it's made of 21 plates mounts. They're intricately engraved. And it's insane. It's like what's inside there is like, whoa, you know. Mm-hmm. You have pieces like that have it's like they're like 4.2 centimeters, and they have just, you know, an enormous amount of detail inside. And it's just, I can't see it with my glasses, you know. It's ridiculous.
I feel like I ask this question every time. Is it aliens? Because I don't have any other explanation other than aliens.
It's slaves.
Oh, is it? But how do you, it's how you get that level of detail on such a small piece without modern technology?
Well, you need a certain type of vision, which I went to the optician to get my glasses updated, and I asked him about what is the percentage of myopical, you know, it's like short, you know, so people that can, you know, that take off the glasses to see from a short distance. Well, those are about 20% of the population in general.
Okay.
So you're talking about one in five that has that kind of vision to begin with. Then you need to be, manually skilled. There's a number of, you know, factors. You're not going to last very long doing that job. And this, the optician told me as well, this, like, just to give you an idea, during the lockdowns, or actually the effect of the lockdowns because of screen time, is that they got 30% more clients for glasses. Yes.
So everybody had, when my mum used to tell me I'd get square eyes, she wasn't lying.
No, she wasn't. So imagine doing that kind of work on, you know, like things like four centimeters.
Yeah, it must be such a strain on the eyes. So would they, do you think they would have chosen people? Would there be centers for this stuff to be made? Would there be like little hubs where these items were made, and they would be skilled, you know, these skilled workers?
I think that if you're talking Gotland, which was, you know, like the highest place for Viking art, from what I can tell, and they were at the highest throughout the Viking Age, even before. To them, Viking Age art-wise was another day at the office, really. And wherever things are important, you know, it's like wherever you see important pieces of art, the highest pieces of art around Scandinavia, there is the seal of Gotland.
Okay. Is that a literal seal? Or?
No, it's not. Well, it can actually, because there's certain types of decoration that they use in specific. For example, they use a certain type of braid ornament around their motifs that looked like a sort of, made out of S's, you know?
Okay.
So just an S-shaped.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
And that they used very specifically. It's not 100% sure, but whenever you see that, it's very likely that it comes from there. And I think that it had to do, because that kind of pattern, especially if it has a sort of an empty gap between the S's, a little gap, it looks very much like the Greek Roman kind of knotwork. It's a bit like they wanted to get, you know, the connection between imperial knotwork and themselves. Okay. So it seems like it. It just gives that. And that you see also, for example, on the Yellingstone. The Yellingstone is a very particular kind of stone because it has the structure of a jewelry box from Gotland. It's like along the ridges, the edges between the surfaces, they got these braids
Okay, yeah.
And then yes. meet at the corners with these trigeteral knots.
Mm-hmm.
That looks exactly like box brooches from Gotland. So it looks as if they were actually that stone. It seems, you know, like motif-wise, as if it was designed by a jeweler from Gotland rather than a stone carver.
Oh, wow. So maybe they just did a little collaboration.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah, good. But you see, just like they pop up where it's important, you know? Mm-hmm. So you can see a lot of the of Gotland work in the Oseberg pieces. So wherever important people wanted important work, Gotland was present.
Okay, before we go on to the main topic, we've already been talking for a while. How do you think this was passed on from person to person? Was it just a case you would go to the workshop and you would practice? Because obviously you can't write things down and you can't.
It's very very complicated to understand how the workshop worked. I mean, I would assume with a difficulty, I mean, like with a short span of time that your vision can work and that detail, that you would pick up the technical the technical abilities to make designs.
Mm-hmm.
And once your eyes can't take it anymore, you would become a sort of a trainer for people, okay, for younger people that would, I mean, that's totally an assumption. It's based on, you know, just how it could, because there's a lot of content also in this artwork, and it's very difficult to understand if, you know, to what extent craftsmen were involved in the magic and the philosophy mm-hmm. behind the narrative inside it, you know.
So do you think maybe there was a designer who came up with the pattern, and then you had the people who crafted it?
There is indications that, I mean, they definitely, I mean, I'm pretty sure that they didn't work like the single artists. You know, it was not like Renoir or, you know, Cézanne working by themselves. They definitely worked in workshops, and there is some indications in some of the works, for example, at Oseberg, that might be a case. For example, there's one pattern on one of the sleds that in which you've got like all creatures that bite into their own bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the heads is missed completely. So it's misunderstood.
Oh, no.
So which is something that as a craftsman yourself, you would think, yeah. I mean, if you did it yourself, you know, if you sketched it up yourself, you wouldn't miss a head, mm-hmm. would you, you know?
Oh, but I bet sometimes it can happen. Is that the one that's, is that the cat one? Is there one that's cats?
No, it's strange beasts in sort of elliptical frames.
Okay.
That go along the runner mm-hmm. all the way to the tip. And the smaller ones, yeah, one of the head is completely, you know, just, it could be, I mean, if it was me, you know, I would make a lot of mistakes, but I wouldn't miss a hit, I think.
Yeah. That was actually going to be my next question of how often do we see mistakes? Because I imagine, you know, this stuff's expensive to produce, something like the sled. If you miss a head, you can't rub it out and start again.
Not really, no. But it's an enormous work. It's So yeah, it's one of the smaller heads. I don't think, you know, I don't think they expected anyone to really notice, because they're really, really densely ornated. And then comes an asshole, you know.
Yeah, they didn't expect Luciano to be there a thousand years later. Exactly. Going, you fucking missed a head. You missed a head.
They nearly got away with it.
Yeah. But but equally, I think any craftsperson, whether it's now or a thousand years ago, doesn't matter if somebody's going to, a true craftsperson, doesn't matter if someone's going to see it or not. If they know they've missed a head, it still must have pissed them off. It's,
absolutely.
You know, they've obviously missed it in the design, and we've all had that realization of anybody who's created anything where you've done something wrong, where you usually realize literally as it's too late, just as you've gone that little bit too far and you finish the bit that's wrong, and you just go, oh no.
Oh no.
Oh no. Exactly. And then you look at it and your heart sinks. So they probably got that feeling and were just like,
oh. But it's very important for studying their, I mean, to get, you know, we're talking about entering their heads. And that is an enormous source of understanding the mistakes. Because when you make a mistake, generally you have to choose between different, you know, different parameters, like which is going to be more important, the knot work or the beak of the bird, you know?
Okay. So can you see examples of where there was a mistake, but it was attempted to be fixed by maybe taking a different path, or then changing the design in some way? Because I know when I've done little bits of knot work before, if I like miss an under or over, or like, you know, I make like a mistake, I'm then trying to redraw the design to make it work again. And I wondered, and it's very hard to do, it very rarely works out. But I wondered if you ever saw that, where maybe something looks a little bit off and it could be because there was an error.
I can see the error. I mean, it's like, yeah, but it's, you don't often see the, you know, an afterthought, a change, but you see that there is a mistake and they had to make a choice. So, for example, it's like on one of the head posts, animal head posts in Ozebir, the most iconic one, the one that looks like a dragon, but actually it's a cat. It's a cat-like creature, most probably. Okay. But on the back of the head, there are four birds, and they decided to make knotwork that is sort of in spirals, spirals that meet, and it's really, really, really tough to make that kind of pattern work. And at that point, they needed to decide whether the knotwork was more important than putting the beak, you know, the top part of the beak over the knotwork.
Okay, yeah.
And that's what, then they decided, obviously, that the recognizability of the animal was more important than the knotwork. So you see a subordination of parameters. So like the recognizability is higher ranking than knotwork.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That is fascinating. So, yeah, okay, so let's jump into
the main mentality
topic. I guess, yeah, and what you think we can learn. Yeah.
Well, I have been wondering for a long time, it's probably, you know, most people, like what it is that the stories in the imagery are about, you know, is there a narrative, what, you know, how do they think them, you know, it's like, and my methodology is to look for systems of narrative that are large enough to actually be studied from within, because most scholars tend to spot certain symbols within a narrative context and then compare them with similar things outside. I try to do that as last resort, really. Mm. I prefer to look into complex narrative contexts, like, for example, the Oseberg motifs, because they were designed for similar purpose. They had, and this is not just general talk, but they were for ritual purposes, and they actually refer to each other. You got connections between them, so you can learn from one narrative what the other narrative is talking about, etc.
Yeah.
So it's a very large context. It's actually the first big narrative source that I've been looking at. And then I've been looking at also, I started with the Kamin casket and the Bamberg casket, because mm-hmm. they were most probably made by the same workshops.
Yeah.
And they tell complex, there is an articulate narrative in them. So you don't have to look outside. You can keep on digging in there and see what you can find, before you can, if I see a bird in one narrative and then I look at other narratives and I see a bird, it doesn't really mean that they are necessarily connected. I actually have had, I found evidence that, a snake in 800 is not the snake, the same symbol that you have in the year 1000.
Okay.
It means something completely different. Yes. I mean, they have a different context. They have a different understanding. The religion has a lot to do with that. So the connection between the Nordic, view of the world more than mythology, and the Christian one, which is it's much wilder than we think. It's like we think generally that you've got the Nordic world, and then you've got Christianity as one huge block surrounding Scandinavia. Yeah. But it's like the brands of Christianity that they had in Spain or in Constantinople were completely different. They had nothing to do with each other. So it's and they were also very imbued with lots of mythological things, imagery that came also from the Greek and Roman world. So it was a much more lively imagery and world view than we generally tend to think when mm-hmm. we think about Christianity. It's like we think about priests and God, and that's it,
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you think we can learn specifically, I guess, from the artwork? Is it more about the mentality of the people making it, or do you think it can give you an insight into like people and culture in general?
You can get an idea of how they told stories. Apparently it's very hard to actually have a clear view, like a literal translation of what it would mean exactly. But you can get the bones of the narrative even beyond just the symbols and start understanding how it is constructed. Because when we think about a narrative, we usually think about a comic strip or a film structure. So we've got frames, that have a certain duration, and then they're followed by other frames that are in that order.
Yeah, in a sequence.
In a sequence, and they have more or less the same time value. Well, apparently, Scandinavians didn't have that at all. I mean, they had a much more complex and varied system of narrative. And that's the very beautifully surprising part of things. Because they went not only in time, but they went also through concepts, ideas, depth of dimensions of beings, for example. So you could have a narrative that doesn't tell a story that, you know, Viking A went to, you know, the god X did, you know, slayed that animal. Okay. And after that, this happened as in a sequential story.
Yeah, it's like a very linear story.
No, generally speaking, well, as a general rule, you can expect more like a mind map sort of construction.
Okay.
So you get like a sort of a central frame, like sort of still in time, in which you're the central part of things. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example, but you need to let me share the screen because it says that you disabled it. Oh,
okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so was this just a bunch of Viking-ish Scandinavians sat around theorizing through artwork? They just had this little brainstorm session on a beautiful brooch, and we've just misinterpreted it.
Well, you know, it's more like it seems like you've got this central event or central point. I mean, this is a very, very rough generalization, but you know, in certain brooches, you do have, you know, so dual meanings and kennings ideas, etc. So, you know, so like sort of poetic structures. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you an example. It's a lot easier to show.
Yeah.
So, for example, this is the inner part of the Oseberg ship.
Wow.
I don't know, you know, so like the way we are looking at it, now we're looking at the direction the ship would be going, right? So this is the inner part. So, and that's why, so we're going forward. So the creatures are looking back at you, right?
Okay.
So that's why they're facing. All the other creatures on the ship are actually depicted sideways on the side of the ship, as if they follow the way, the movement of the ship. And this side, they're actually looking at the people inside the ship. And
do you think things like that are on purpose or could just be coincidental? Like, is it too easy to look for things, or do you think they're at that level where they are doing, you know, this kind of small detail on purpose?
I think it's quite. It's. I mean, we're looking at rather sophisticated kind of narrative. So yes, they did on purpose. I'm pretty sure. I mean, it's like if you look at this. This imagery, we see a jumble of creatures. But if you look carefully, I mean, it's like a think composition, because that's the thing. That's what I do differently from the classic scholars, generally speaking. Symbols are a problem. Symbols is what everybody wants to know about. But symbols is is an inside language. So if you go into, if you join, a youth group and they have an inside language, you're out. There is no way you can get in there without any, that's the purpose of the inside language. So getting into that symbology is it's like facing a steel door. Mm-hmm. And that's why I try, it's like identify that there are symbols in certain places. But what I try to do is to look at the different level of the narrative. And this different level that actually helps you in is the composition of an image. Mm-hmm. Especially the more articulate, the more it will explain, because not all the narratives, especially when they're quite articulate, they're not necessarily well known. So you might know the symbols, but you might not know the construction of this specific narrative. So the composition is designed to let the onlooker in, as opposed to the symbology. So here's an example. If you look at this imagery,
just quickly for anybody who is just listening, the episodes are all available on YouTube, so you can pause where you're listening and pop over to the YouTube channel, Just Nordic Mythology Podcast, and you'll be able to see the visuals as well, because they do always help when we do episodes with you, Luciana. You always bring something very fascinating to show.
Yeah, it's difficult to explain it in abstract, because it is absolutely about a visual experience.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. So in this picture, for example, you've got a very vertical construction. And the first thing that you can see practically is that the top character, I don't know how to, can you see the whole screen? Okay.
They kind of remind me of, what's that famous painting? Is it
the scream.
The scream mask? Monk? Is it Monk?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know why they just remind me of that. He was Norwegian, right?
Also Norwegian, yes, exactly. Yeah. But these, it might be, inspired by these things. I mean, that's not really. But if you look at the way they're put together, it's like how they're connected. At the top, you see a character with a very long and wide beard. And the second one has less beard on the cheeks. And the third one has no beard.
Oh.
So it looks... Yeah,
I don't know what I was going to say. Something derogatory about not having a beard, and then I kept it to myself.
No, but it's like it looks a little like a lineage.
Okay,
so you're going from
that was my second thought.
So from the eldest to old and younger, and if you look at the whole construction, like we were talking about composition, so the composition of this thing has a specific structure, and it's structured as a sort of chain or braid. So it kind of underlines the connections between these creatures, these people.
Mm-hmm. Everything. Lucia, I find this so fascinating. Like I just, until you showed this second image with that clearly shows like all how it all flows together, it was just it wasn't a mess. It's a very carefully made piece of art, but it on its surface level, it's just this really cool.
Looks messy.
And then when you show the composition like side by side, it's like, oh, there is method to the madness.
Absolutely.
Everything is done for a reason.
Now, you tell me what happens at the end, because this is where it ends. So you've got like a sort of braid thing, and then it ends at the bottom in a sort of circular motion, you know, like there is a sort of whirlpool or whirlwind around one specific figure. So that's the one frame that I was telling you about before, you know. So you've got like a composition. It's like you don't have a sequence of frames, but you have side things that go towards the central image. And the central image looks like an important character. Now, we'll probably never know who this character is, but this character is subduing two beasts.
Could we go back to the other one?
Yeah, absolutely.
And just see it.
So there, there you go.
And like it's finished glory. Yes. So do you think this is going from the top down, not from the bottom up?
Absolutely, yes. I think, well, it's actually the interesting thing is that it's going both ways.
The more you look at it, the more insane it is, because it's like he's holding, I say he, could be a she, the beard would.
The beard, maybe. But, you know, hey, not every.
I'm not going to discriminate.
Exactly.
He or she is holding other beasts or people by the necks.
Exactly.
The legs and the arms. So he's, like you say, subduing something.
Exactly.
Also looks quite tormented. He looks quite in pain.
It's a fight. It's a struggle. He's still, you know, subduing these creatures with his feet. That's how cool he is. Yeah. But it's a struggle. And what you see beneath is actually those two creatures looking at you.
Can we zoom in on that? Sorry. Oh, so there they are.
Yeah, there they are. So they go. So it goes upwards and back, but then downwards. So it goes towards the central bit, which is where, you know, that's where the main frame is. In that sense, I meant that, you know, you don't have a sequence going towards something. You have different things going towards the central event. It's a bit like when, you know, when you see a film that is, or a Tarantino film, where you've got, you know, different threads that go towards one specific, you know, ending or, you know, plot twist.
It kind of jumps around, but it's all geared towards the...
Exactly.
This is so fascinating. So clearly you have the two beasts there, and then they're in the battle and they're being subdued. So do you not think that this could just be going from bottom up? It's like there's the two beasts, whoever this hero of some sort was, he subdued them, and then the rest of it is kind of the progression through his life as he gets older into old age.
I don't think it's I think it's more like the way, you know, it's like it's more like his ancestry that is being given. It's like you need to look at it as a sort of a Chinese box, sort of, you know. You've got all kinds of because, you know, not it's a very layered way of telling stories. So you will have a superficial narrative. That's what we discovered just right now. But if you were into this narrative from a deeper point of view and you knew who this hero was or who he represented, you'd probably know also more about his ancestors.
Okay,
so
right.
every figure would probably be a story in itself. So you need, you would need an interpreter to actually, you know, unbox every part of the story. So it's a many layered thing.
The top ones in particular are they're quite spectral.
Yeah, absolutely.
They do have that. So, okay, one thing that jumps out at me is they're very humanoid. Even the two beasts, they are very, they have human faces, whereas, you know, anybody who's looked at kind of Viking Age artwork, you the beasts are beasts. They're even the ones that represent a bear or a lion, they're still very elaborate. They're very beast-like, whereas these look very human. They've got two eyes. They've got a mouth, and then a little tuft of hair on the top of the head.
Yeah, but the beasts are actually if you looked at their body structure, they're very much, I mean, it's like they're rather different from the humanoid creatures, and the humanoid creatures become less definite the farthest they go. So as if, you know, like the further ancestors just kind of lose their bodily structure, you know. So this one has sort of a wisp as legs instead of
they're more like mermaids.
Exactly, and the further down you go, they've got arms and legs.
They look like ham. They look like ham shanks for legs.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Or tennis rackets.
Exactly, or both. You know.
But that's a good point. They do get less human.
Yeah, and the creatures on the sides have holes in them. For example, they are they're very, very inhuman, you know, like they, you know, it's like if you look at down there, like in their hips and their chest, they're different creatures, and they look very similar to the ones on the side of the ship. They're from the front.
So what about the faces and the heads, though? Because the heads do look human to me, or is that just...
I don't know. I mean, I find them a bit weird, more like ghost-like.
Okay,
they're a bit like elongated. It's a bit like they're showing, like these beasts from the front. I didn't know exactly how to represent them. It's a bit like medieval horses, you know, when they made them from the front, they looked really weird, you know, sort of. I mean, there are certain anatomical parts that we're still talking about fantasy creatures, so it's a bit complicated to... you know, to pin down to a certain type of anatomy. But this is the type of narrative you're looking at, and it's rather common, and it's quite articulate. I mean, even 200 years later, when you look at the Bamber casket and the Camin casket, I figured out that there are three. I mean, between the two caskets, and there I should give you a visual, because that is quite rather important. Between the two caskets, you've got like, so this is the Bamberg casket, and this is the Camin casket. And between the two, there are three different systems of narrative. There is one system of narrative for the Bamberg casket, which is based on a sort of it's a puzzle. So you've got a jumble of symbols, and they are twisted around. So the lid is.
When you say a puzzle, do you mean like a puzzle box
or just? Yes, it's like there's a number of symbols, and they correspond to each other, but they are turned by 90 degrees.
Every time I see this, it blows my mind.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I implore anybody who's only listening to this to just go over to the YouTube channel and have a look at the visuals, because and this thing isn't, it's not big. You can see the level of detail on this image, but it's not. It's not huge.
It's not that big. No, it's just
it just blows my mind. I'm sorry to interrupt, but every time I just like, it really does tear me back. And I think until you really see it, and particularly when it's It's your creation, your I forgot on the word. Recreation? Yeah, your recreation of it. Yeah, your reconstruction is it really highlights the details. Obviously, when you look at the original, it's all a little bit worn, but when you've gone in and really done this detailed work of bringing it all back to life and you can almost see the clean edges, it just really makes, you know, accentuates the amount of detail in and you can you can carry on with the fascinating thing about it being a puzzle.
Well, there are a number of symbols. So you've got like you've got birds here on the lid at the bottom part of the lid, and then on the right side you have something that looks like dragon-like creatures. Let's say at the top you've got a mask, and then on the left side you've got a lion slash wolf-like creature. Well, these symbols are repeated on the central panels on the signs, but they don't correspond directly. It is as if the lid has been turned 90 degrees counterclockwise. So the dragon, or the dragon between quotes, you see on the top right, are represented at the bottom center panel.
Okay.
And then the birds on the lid at the bottom, you know, two eagle-like creatures, are connected to the panel, to central panel
on the left.
On the left, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And then you've got the lion at, or lion slash wolf. That it's at the top. And then
what about the mask?
The mask is interesting because it corresponds to three creatures, not only the central one, but the three creatures that are on the lid. So you've got like a dragon. So on the right side, you see there's three panels. One is dragon, one is a bird, and one is a lion, or lion slash wolf. So the mask corresponds to the other three symbols on the lid. So it's precisely turned 90 degrees counterclockwise.
Okay, so on, obviously, I know you said that you've got the bird. On the, is the bottom of, is the image at the bottom, and it is the central image on the one to the left. So, what are the two images either side? I just assume that there are the other two missing creatures from the lid. That you would have the lion and the dragon, and you would just have the three. But that's not.
No, right. That's not the case.
It's only the one on the right-hand side that has
exactly,
all three.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm with you now.
But on the right side, you actually have a composition in a triangular shape that is actually in its right place. So that looks as if the lid was not misplaced later, but it was meant to be like that. Because you've got these on the left side, you've got the lion slash wolf creature. And then underneath you've got these lion-like bodies with a humanoid mask with mustache and beard. And they are moving in towards a central bird, right?
Okay.
Well, keep that in mind and you'll see it on the Kamin casket as well. So on one side of the Kamin casket, you've got exactly the same composition.
Okay.
So on top, we've got the Kamin casket, and you've got like the lion slash wolf, and you've got these two mythological creatures with a lion body-esque thing.
Okay.
I've been told lately what they might be, manticores.
For me, just to get this in my head, so it seems like the image that is on the lid is the central image of the one nine turn 90 degrees just clockwise, but the image on the lid is also the two side images of the one that it directly correlates to and is attached to.
Exactly. So it's like,
so it seems like it is meant, it is in the right place.
It is in the right place, but it's actually, there is a puzzle going on. And then there is this reference between the Kamin casket or the Bamberg casket that was done before here below, in which you've got this lion wolf kind of creature at the top. Then you've got like the bird underneath, and then you've got these two, humanoid-faced lion bodies moving towards the bird. Mm-hmm. On the coming casket, you've got same creature at the top. You've got two birds underneath instead of one, and these two creatures that look exactly like the ones on the Bamberg casket are moving outwards instead of inwards.
Okay.
Like they're being outnumbered or something. This is, but it's obviously a reference because these creatures with lion-esque bodies and a mask only appear in these combination and nowhere else. So it seems unlikely that there is no correspondence. I mean, it's like the chances of them being, like exactly in the same sort of triangular position by chance is mm-hmm. quite slim. So you've got like that turn lid, then you've got these correspondence of these two triangular shapes. And then on the Kamin casket, you've got another story. And it's another story that is very, very interesting too, mm-hmm. because it actually revealed what I actually think is spirits.
Okay.
So we are talking here about, these caskets were for Christian patrons. So there is a lot of mythology. They're sort of politically correct. There is no, Nordic gods, obviously, in the imagery.
So what would be the mask? Is that not like a type of god mask, the one that isn't replicated on the side?
Well, the thing is that there is no such thing as a god mask. Generally speaking, when you see an image, so like imagine remember that the bellows stone or the like furnace stone with a Loki face, mm-hmm. On that stone with a stitched mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you look at it, it's a face. It's not a mask.
Okay.
And there is a difference between a mask and a face.
Yeah.
It's like very often when you see, creature, like in that case, Loki, imagery, it doesn't look like a mask. It doesn't have the tendrils going out like a sort of, like the construction that you would, imagine on a prop sort of thing. You see a face. That is a face. It's not a mask. So you need to make a distinction between the two. Generally speaking, when you look at a mask, you're looking at a gate, a door. So this, this is the Kamin casket, and at the two extremities on the right and the left,
okay,
you've got these two masks, and they are, are very obviously, it's like you can also see with the 3D images that are constructed on top of the originals. There's like a sort of, griffin-like creature and two wolves hovering over the entrance. And mm-hmm. they are very much gates, they are doors. You know.
Okay. And so what do you think, or can you speculate as to what that might mean? And is that only found on things like that, or is that like a general rule of thumb that you would find these kind of masks on doorways in other places? Yeah.
Well, it's like that. Well, they're more like. I mean, it's a general idea. I mean, it's like the thing with masks is that in the West we are not really familiar with what a mask is, because that's where Christianity has done its job. Because if you ask anybody else, like from Japanese to Balinese to Africans, they'll tell you that, you know, like a mask is a doorway to other places, you know, to other dimensions. You put that on and you don't know what's coming out. You know, it's like it's a doorway. It's also a tricky thing. You don't play around with it. It's something that may be dangerous.
Okay.
And I went to, in 2009, I went to a mask making course and in Padua, with a family of traditional family of mask makers, and they are amazing. They supply the best masks in Italy, practically. For every theater that makes sense has a Sartori mask, at least. And the sister of the main man was an actress, and she gave a workshop in West Africa, and she did a skit with a mask just to show what happens when you put on a mask and you actually impersonate something. And I knew what was going on, but if I hadn't been given the context, it was creepy. You know, the way, you know, because, you know, she put on the mask, was this woman called Serena, very nice woman, you know, puts on a shawl and, you know, half masked, and then puts a hand down, and then her fingers start to shake, and then the shaking starts, you know, moving up the arms all the way to the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And then it hits the back, and, you know, and she goes bent, and she starts shaking all over like an old lady.
Yeah.
And then she became something completely different. She was like, she lost completely her own, you know, it's like, so her face basically made her body become, you know, it's like there was this connection between the face that was not her face and her body that basically became something different. Yeah. It's as if she let something in.
But a mask is a very powerful thing when you
crazy. Put it
like that. Even today, I think it may not be always a physical like item that you put on, but I think for, you know, there's probably a lot of women who would consider their makeup as a type of mask that then gives them a whole different level of confidence. Yeah. And I think you probably get it with I would say with probably a lot of trans people when they get to be themselves and who they really are, and they get the chance to put the makeup on and dress in the clothes that they, you know, that suit them best, that they probably shake off and almost lose all this weight that they feel when maybe they're forced to dress.
I mean, isn't that very
inappropriate? Yeah, exactly. So they, I bet they, once they kind of put them, I don't want to say mask might not be the right word, but they, you know, they put on the real self, you get freedom from everything else. And it's a very powerful thing. And even just in a literal sense of putting a mask on, I think anybody who's ever done, maybe even side down, as silly as it is, like fancy dress on Halloween, if you have like a costume that covers your face, you almost feel a little sense of invincibility, like it's not really you. You can maybe be a little bit more silly. You can can play up a little bit because you're hidden. And it's as trivial as just a thing over your face, and everybody still knows it's you, but you kind of get this sense that it's not quite you. And
exactly, yeah. But it's like, you know, it's like in that sense, as you were saying, and you put on your that makeup, but it's not like they don't have that, what they express through that makeup and the whole, you know, like paraphernalia that you could put on. It's not that they don't have it inside. It's just that it gets an exit, you know, it gets a way to get out, you know. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it becomes a gate. You know, it's like that mask, it just lets out what can come in. Mm-hmm. I was telling this lady, it was just showing what happens behind when you impersonate the mask, when you become the character. And she was doing that at a course, you know, a workshop in West Africa. And, you know, the skit that she put on, basically, you know, turned around the idea that, you know, she would play this old lady and she would ask for a chair because her back was hurting. And you really feel very guilty and compelled to give her a chair immediately. So that's what happened also at a workshop in West Africa. I think it was Senegal. And a lady gave her a chair. But in that case, as she did in the skit that she showed us, she, after that, she wants to thank you. So it's part of the skit. So she asks your name. It's like, what's your name? And then since she's an old lady, so as part of the skit, she asks again because she can't hear you and you have to, mm-hmm. you end up shouting your name.
Okay, yeah.
But what happened there in that session in Senegal is that this lady went sort of gray because she couldn't go white, and she backed off and she said, no, I'm not giving my name to that.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not you, you know, there's something that's come through and I'm giving, you know, I'm not giving my name, my ID, my IP to something out there on the other side.
Yeah.
So that's the value of a mask that we have lost, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in this context, it is really a gate. And just briefly before, you know, we go too far, there is another level to this, the narrative. And there is it's a sort of, in this picture, there is, so at the top, you've got that triangle with this lion / wolf and the birds and the two, mythological creatures that are moving away. But on the other side, you actually have an actual narrative. It's a double narrative. And it's most probably, it's the closest we get to a moral story, like the Havamal kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's quite interesting because at the bottom, on the two sides, you've got two birds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. These two birds are actually repeated in the frames that follow upwards. So the bird on the bottom left is repeated on top of that frame and on top of that again. It has exactly the same characteristics. It's got the head turned back. And if you compare it to the other birds that are there, they're just different. But these look, you know, that they are repeated, you know, imagine like in a comic strip. And on the right-hand side, you've got another bird, also very specifically characterized, that is repeated also on top, but then to the right.
Yeah.
So in these three sequential orders. So it's a parallel story that's going on. And it tells about these birds. So, and from the posture of these birds, this took me 5 years to figure out. So from the top posture of the birds, you can tell what kind of, you know, personality they have. So it's a bit like that, you know, on the right part of the ring, you've got this, and on the left side, so you've got this bird on the left side that is very flustered, is completely stressed, looks very stressed out. Actually,
oh, yeah, he does.
Yeah, so with a head backwards, and mm-hmm. also the endings of the feathers, most of them end in a sort of S kind of shape, which looks like it indicates broken feathers or ruffled feathers.
Okay.
You know, because of the position. And yeah. It's, you know, it's all over the place. So it's got like spread legs, head backwards, all the feathers all over the place. While the other bird instead is quite...
It's cocky.
Yeah, it's cocky, it's in place, you know, it's got, it's, yeah. You know, it's got... Is
the rooster
in control, right? You know, the endings of the tendrils, you know, are whole. You know, they're not just a few, just a couple are end up in an S shape, but for the rest, they're very neat. He's in control, you know.
Yeah,
and they're actually both moving away from. A danger, say, like it's a twin danger. And the danger is characterized by these two dragon-like creatures. So you see the head over here mm-hmm. of one of the two.
Okay.
And they are actually depicted in a sort of specular, a diagonal mirror image.
Yeah.
So you got like whatever, what you got on the one side, you've got on the other side in a diagonal sense. Mm-hmm. And they're like twin dragons, like, or dread, whatever, worm-like yeah. creatures. Right?
It's kind of almost like an Ouroboros, but that kind yeah. of similar exactly. shape.
Exactly. And they are threatening the birds. You know, because the sequence of the frames actually has them in fight in the next frames. So they okay. actually enter a conflict. But there is a difference, you know, in the two conflicts, you know. And the ending is also different depending on the attitude of the bird.
Okay.
And what I discovered lately, because, you know, not, you know, there is very little, especially if there is a creature, then there is a meaning to it. And I always thought that snakes, you know, you can see them here. Here's a snake head. You see the triangular shape?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's a snake. And there are more. So there is another one here. Mm-hmm. And so they actually... play a part. And they actually correspond to certain creatures and they help them out in the fight. So it made me think that, you know, through the composition, again, we get to the composition. So we get through to the symbology through the back door, pretty much, instead of going straight to the symbology from here to, mm-hmm. you know, other books or other imagery somewhere else. So inside, there is enough information to actually get you through that. And so every dragon here has three snakes with them. So the dragon on the right has a snake over here yeah. at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then has two at the bottom, like okay. there. So one and two. And as a mirror image on the other side, exactly the same. So yes, one, two, at the, yeah. one at the corner and two at the top. So they seem to represent, because they actually help the creatures in their fight, they seem to represent what is called usually in the Nordic mythology context, Hamingja, that is the personification of luck.
Okay.
So they actually are the physical representation of a creature's luck.
Okay, wow.
So they're the embodiment. So these, you know, there are stories in which, you know, like the fights have been avoided because the, you know, the opponent had visible, you know, visibly, they outnumbered you in luck, you know, because these creatures were very obvious. So these dragons are rather strong. They've got like a lot of that. And the flustered bird has none. There is no snake in this frame. While the cocky one has one, that is between his tail and wings.
Okay.
So right, yep. There. Mm-hmm. So we've got like they obviously in disadvantage both, but you know the cocky one has a sort of an edge.
Yeah.
And what happens immediately in the first conflict with the stressed bird is that, well, he keeps being stressed with the head backwards,
mm-hmm.
and the dragon gets the upper hand. Even if, you know, if you look at the two fights, you know, on the other side, they're actually in the same position, but the attitude is completely different.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You can see, you know, it's like the bird's on top, but here's the, you know, it's like the bird is like he's attacking. The predator.
Exactly. He's on the offense, whereas exactly. on the other one, the other one is
stressing out.
Yeah.
And if you look at the snake, there is a snake that is entangling the one wing and the tail of the bird,
yeah.
while the dragon is holding the other one. So it's mm-hmm. actually physically helping to tie the bird down to defeat yeah. it. While on the other side, you've got this bird that is on top, is just comfortably on the dragon's butt.
Yeah.
You know, it's just standing straight.
Yeah.
And it's got two snakes, one that is holding the dragon's headdress and neck, and the other mm-hmm. one, so his luck has multiplied through attitude. Mm-hmm. And he's got another snake here that is holding the hip okay. of the dragon down. So the dragon is being held down by, you know, it's like the bird is attacking, but, you know, it's being helped,
mm-hmm.
literally. And how it ends in the second part is that the dragon pretty much strangles the bird, literally using his luck in his mouth, so using the snake. So mm-hmm. the snake actually helps him to tie the headdress and the neck of the bird down.
Yeah,
so that doesn't end very nicely.
No,
I think that's pretty much the end.
Yeah.
So the luck is what you happens. Yeah, he's literally run out. It's
yes.
like gone away. And on the other hand, this bird, which is still a bird against the dragon, makes its getaway.
Yeah,
so you can see it. And it goes. Yeah, he's on his own with a snake around his neck. And he's heading towards the door.
And he looks proud. He looks very...
He's having a laugh.
I don't know why that bird feels like it could be a symbol of America. Yeah, I don't know why that came to my mind then. I was just like, he just looks very proud and...
Yeah, right. Very cocky. And it's going right to the door, you know, to the mask.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see in the next picture, you see a tree-like shape that kind of fills the whole picture. With the dragon entangled in it, as if it's searching through the forest, but he can't find its prey, and it's got like his jaws completely opened wide,
yeah.
as if he's completely mad, you know, because mm-hmm. he can't find his prey anymore. So
he's got a lot of
been tricked.
But he has a lot of snakes around him still.
Yeah, he's got two snakes. No.
Two snakes, is it? Just the two.
Exactly. So it's, but you know, he's been tricked through attitude, mm-hmm. so to speak. So you've got like a sort of what looks like a would moral that, story.
So would there be any symbology to, because they had three snakes to start with, because
they seem to vary according to the. To the attitude.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I wondered whether the confident bird had taken one of the snakes, but he started with one anyway, so that wouldn't be.
He got away with the luck he had, but it just like it's not only the luck; it's the attitude. You know, it's keeping a level head gets you through, overwhelming odds.
Mm-hmm.
While, you know, if you stress out, that's what it seems to look like.
Yeah.
You know, so but it's obviously a double narrative, you know, it's, so as you can see, you know, between two caskets, you've got three systems of symbology. And narrative, so it's a rather complex, array of things. You know, it's not your classic, you know, frame after frame.
But it's not as superficial as you may think.
No.
When you just look at it, because you know it just looks like a very beautiful piece of art.
Mm-mm.
But there is obviously clearly so much more meaning and depth to it than.
Absolutely.
We probably ever realize. Okay, Luciano, we're going to have to wrap this up because we're nearly 2 hours. Our episodes always go long. And we are going to do a quick Q&A with the patrons as well. So if you want more of Luciano, like I say, we've got three previous episodes with him. You can also get the Q&A we're going to do right now, where I'm sure you will pull up many more images. You can access the Q&A by supporting us on Patreon. Every week you get a bonus episode with the guest after the main show where you can ask your own questions or just hear us discuss a little bit further. The episode that's literally from £3 a month. It's the price of buying me a coffee. And like I say, it helps us just keep going and keep growing. Luciano, first of all, thank you very much. It's just fascinating as always. Nobody, there's no other guest that comes on here that makes my head hurt as much as you do. And trust me, that's a compliment. If you want to give a shout out where people can follow you and see your work.
Mostly I do my posts on Children of Ash on Instagram and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I also, I'm planning. Yeah, I used to have a Patreon page, but it was taking me a bit too much off my research. I want to find different ways of getting out there. So I think I'm going to I'm about to start a merch site. Simple one, but showing all the breakdowns that I've, you know, all the imagery that I do. So slowly I will start going in that direction. And but hopefully it will be combined with posts and sort of small blog about all the things that I, you know, all the insights that I discover. So,
sort of educational material on this stuff with the images that you've compiled, I mean, people would eat it up. Honestly.
Hopefully, yes. That'd be
it
really
is so
nice.
Fascinating.
Thanks a lot.
And I love talking to you, whether it's on a personal level or on the podcast. You teach me so much and I appreciate you spending the time. And let's answer some questions from the patron. And I have no doubt that you will be back for a fifth time with some more incredible images to show us.
And one thing, yes, I wrote an article for a book that is going coming out with a it's my sort of debut in the academic sense, and will be in a book that will come out in May. It's called Norse Sorceress, and it's going to talk specifically about the secrets that are hide in one of the main artifacts in the Oseberg. In the Oseberg funeral ship, which is the wagon. I actually talk about the narrative on it.
Oh, wow. Well, there we go. That's our next episode sorted.
Most probably, yes. Absolutely.
And also, I don't know if most people know that you're actually a tattooist as well. And
absolutely.
You've just moved to your own studio.
Definitely, yes.
So do you have like a tattoo page?
Yes, I have a tattoo page. It's called Notis Compungo. I think I can just put the name connect on the Children of Ash Instagram page so you can find it. Yes, I'll do that. So you can click on that.
Yeah, and we'll put it in the description as well. So if you enjoy Luciana's work, obviously, you know, it's without doubt, I genuinely do think you are, if not the most, one of the most knowledgeable people on this
art
style that we have. So if you would like to get a tattoo by Luciana, and I know you're very particular, you know, you have to, when you tattoo, it's accurate. You keep things.
Yes, you'll get a historical image. You will get a tattoo that if you travel back in time, the people that you know that belong to that cultural setting, they would recognize what you got.
That's beautiful. I need to come and get something by your point.
Yes.
It would be my pleasure. So Luciana, again, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's answer some questions.
All right, let's do that.
Perfect.